Welcome to the Post-Capitalism Podcast. I'm Chris Willard. In this episode, we'll be talking about how universal basic services can help move us towards establishing a more equitable, efficient, and sustainable society. My guest is Anna Coote, an analyst, writer, and social policy advocate, and principal fellow at the New Economics Foundation in the UK. We'll be discussing everything from the welfare state and food deserts to human needs and the problem with universal basic income. We hope you enjoy the episode. So Anna, to frame our conversation today, I was hoping you could provide a brief overview of the idea of what universal basic services is, maybe a bit about the broad philosophy behind it, and some of the things we might consider putting within it, if it was an idea that we were to implement in practice.
Sure. The idea of universal services came originally out of a critique of the calls for universal basic income, but it was mainly about saying, actually, if we want people to lead the lives that they value, then they need not just money, they also need services and collective measures, other collective measures that people do together to enable them to get what they need. So it's the idea of saying it's not just money we need, it's services too. And it's trying to reclaim the collective ideal that really inspired the post-war welfare settlement. So we need to do these things together. We are not just individuals, we stand and fall together. So it's about collective action, it's about meeting everyone's needs, and it's about services, not just cash transfers in terms of social policy.
Maybe we can get a little bit more into that history here. When we talk about the post-war welfare state as a starting point, I guess we're thinking about what happened in the UK in particular at that time. What were some of the main tenets of the welfare state in the UK at that moment, and some of the services people received, how it was funded, and so on?
Well, in a way, it was just a massive effort to support full employment and to support the capitalist system in that it was about making sure that everyone had income support if they didn't have a job, had housing, had education, had healthcare, and that these were all available to people without them having to pay for it directly. It was funded through taxation and national insurance. So that was the idea of trying to rebuild the economy after the Second World War and to keep the wheels of the system turning at the time.
I think it's interesting and entirely accurate, as you've just said, to frame the welfare state as a capitalist instrument in an essential way. Do you think that UBS is part of the capitalist system in the same way, or is it maybe more of a prefigurative way for us to build towards something very different?
Well, the great thing about the idea of universal basic services is that it's both radical and it's pragmatic. So you can move gradually from where we are now to where we would like to be. So we're saying, well, we have some services that are already universal, like healthcare, certainly in the UK, but education is usually a universal service that everybody gets without having to pay for it. But there are other things we need as well, like housing, like childcare, adult social care. And nowadays we would say people need access to transport and they need access to the internet. Everyone should have a right to access to these essentials. So that's the idea. And it could both be a part of a capitalist system. I wouldn't want to suggest that it's just about post-capitalism, but it's certainly about supporting and helping to develop a system that is sustainable. And then you can get into a debate about whether capitalism can ever be part of a sustainable economic system. If you can separate market activities from the cumulative and extractive tendencies of contemporary capitalism, like neoliberal capitalism, then I'd say that it was probably part of that, can be part of a market system. It also could be part of a post-capitalist system if we can try to envisage such a thing, which I'm sure is what you're interested in.
Yeah, the name of the podcast is certainly a bit of a giveaway there, isn't it? We've sort of put our thumb on the scale out there on that, unfortunately. But I think there's a really useful point you make in that you can potentially introduce different services under capitalism. And then rather than require people to imagine a radically different future with no basis in the present, you can give them concrete examples of things that already exist and are already working. And that feels like a really big advantage.
It's about the transition from where we are now, the kind of the capitalist system we have, to the what kind of economy we need for the future. We must have an economy that is there to serve the interests of people and the planet, and not an economy that is there to extract the assets of people and the planet in order to create profits, and to, which is dependent on accumulation and growth. So the idea of universal basic services, which is about pooling resources and sharing risks and working together to make sure everybody gets what they need, that's what we're aiming for. And that, I think, is what will be helpful in trying to construct a sustainable economy.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I also think there's a valuable linguistic turn here as well. I think a lot of the ideas that maybe smack of socialism or communism get bogged down with the old language that we used to rely on, whereas UBS offers us a new way to talk about some of the goals we want to achieve, but without that baggage in terms of vocabulary or in terms of mental association.
Well, we've certainly found that people are prepared to talk to us without being afraid that we're too revolutionary or, you know, we're demanding a complete overhaul or something, that sort of single bullet suggestion, solution to the problems that we've got. This is something people can ease themselves into. I'm talking about policymakers here. People who are interested in policy development can ease their way into it. But I don't think that means that it's just, you know, it's vague or wishy-washy or too so gradualist it doesn't really have any bite. I think it's a genuinely radical idea, and I'm not sure that universal basic income is going to help us very much.
Oh, we'll be coming back to that for sure. But to stick with universal basic services for a minute, I think there's a useful conversation to be had around what qualifies something as a basic service that we all need, and what are the criteria for something that everybody needs access to in that sort of egalitarian way.
Right, so we start with the idea of what people need. So it's based in need theory, and to a large extent also in the capability theories that people like Martha Nussbaum has developed. So that's where we start with objective evidence about what everybody needs in order to survive and to participate in society. And also, whenever you get into conversations with people at a local level, they will almost always reflect those same needs. You know, people need education, healthcare, housing, childcare, adult social care. Of course, the utilities and, you know, you need access to clean air and water and sanitation. Some would say you need access to legal services as well. I mean, we tend to focus on a particular range of these needs, but we wouldn't say that what we're focusing on is a definitive list. So we focus on healthcare and education, acknowledging that they are already there in a way as universal services, but then housing, transport, and access to the internet. You know, we also talk about food, which is a very interesting example, because this is something where, although we don't focus on food is obviously one of the things that everybody needs. They need nutrition in order to survive and participate in society, and nobody would disagree with that. Usually, almost anywhere, people expect to be able to pay for food themselves. And that's why you need a decent income as well as services to buy things like food, where the expectation is that you will acquire what you need yourself through individual market transactions, if you like. But what people need is not just food. They need nutritious food. And they need food that is available to them, that they can get hold of and are able to buy. So they need it to be affordable, they need it to be accessible, they need it to be nutritious. And from a wider perspective, you need food to be sustainable, sustainably produced. You need a combination of individual expenditure for which individuals need a decent income, and collective measures through investment and regulation to ensure that the food is accessible, affordable, sustainable.
It's a common and depressing problem in America for sure, with food deserts where people don't have the ability to access nutritious food that's actually good for you. A lot of independent stores have been taken over by dollar stores or by chains, where you can definitely buy a lot of packaged food, but fruit and vegetables are few and far between. That feels like a very real form of market failure to me.
It is, yes, that's right. And so there's always this crossover between certainly where food and to a certain extent where housing is concerned as well, where, you know, to say that these things can simply be provided through the collective, through public institutions or whatever, through governments, would be misleading. Everybody can't get access to them at a level of sufficiency without collective intervention.
Yeah, that takes me back to something you mentioned earlier, I think, about the split between need and capability theory. Because I think there's a clear need for certain things. But then on a capability side, I wonder if we're talking about individual agency and the ability not just to receive something, but to take that step forward and go out and do the things that you want to do.
Yes, it is. But I mean, there's an awful lot of convergence among need theorists about what the essentials are, because they both talk in, well, I'm talking about Imhoff and Len Doyle and their book A Theory of Human Need, and then Martha Nussbaum's later writing on capabilities, where they do converge around health and what has been called critical autonomy. So that's about agency. It's about not just autonomy, it's about being able to think for yourself and take control of your life. So these are needs. And in order to have those needs satisfied, you need to have other things, like you need to be sure you're going to be, well, you need access to education and healthcare and so on. So, and nutritious food and decent housing and things like that. So there are different levels of need. You've got the sort of basic needs and then the generic things that satisfy them. And that's where we look at what we call life's essentials. And that's where universal basic services come in. And services are, in that context, it's a shorthand for much more than services. So universal basic services certainly isn't just about doing things, you know, giving things to people. It's about collective action of different kinds, of which the provision of services is probably the main one, but there's also regulation and investment that is collective.
So I think this would be a good point to talk about an initiative you've very much been involved in, as earlier this year you launched the Social Guarantee. So I was hoping maybe you could talk to us a little bit about what the Social Guarantee is, what its founding principles are, what it's aiming to do, and anything else you think might be interesting or useful for us to hear.
Sure. Well, I hope you can encourage your listeners to have a look at our website, www.socialguarantee.org. It was only launched in July this year, 2021. We decided this is a way of reframing what we were trying to do with universal basic services, because many of us thought that it was quite a mouthful, universal basic services, and it was always seen as being in direct opposition to universal basic income. So what the social guarantee is, it is about securing life's essentials for everyone as a matter of entitlement. So it's very like universal basic services, but it's got two elements to it. One is a living income and the other is universal services. Living income is made up of a fair living wage and a guaranteed minimum income. Now, by that, we mean everyone should have a right to an income that doesn't fall below an agreed level of sufficiency. And that is different from universal basic income, which says that everybody, regardless of what they need, should have access to regular unconditional cash payments. So, but we hope that a lot of the advocates for UBI who are looking for some way of overcoming the weaknesses of many social security systems in different parts of the world will accept that a universal income guarantee would fulfill a lot of what they're trying to achieve. And the reason why it's important that it is a guaranteed minimum income and not a universal basic income is that it is fiscally compatible with universal services. In other words, it doesn't cost so much that it'll wipe out all the funds that would be that we need to develop and extend the range of and improve the range of universal services. So the two work together quite well. And then the living wage bit is about making sure everybody who's in work has a decent living wage. And that's something that there's, you know, separate campaigns about that, but it's also part of the picture. And the universal service part is the bit that says these are in-kind benefits. So you have cash benefits on one side and then in-kind benefits made up of these services and these forms of collective action that are worth money to people, but they're not actual money. So it's a social wage, if you like, or a virtual income, which is worth a great deal more to low-income families than to others. So it's highly redistributed. And there's plenty of evidence about this. So it's helped to promote greater equality as well as to meet people's needs. And the two together, the living income and the universal services, make up the social guarantee. And the idea is that these should be available to people as a matter of right, not as a concession or a privilege.
Who have you been talking to so far, and what sort of conversations have you been having?
The social guarantee is about developing and raising awareness about universal basic services and the fair living income. We've been talking to the Scottish Government. We've been talking to the Wales Institute for Social Research and Development. We've been talking to the New Economy Forum in Berlin. We've been on. So we're building up over time. And I think this is really going well. We've been talking to the TUC in London, and we've had a lot to do with Public Services International, which is a global trade union federation, and they've published their own report on universal quality public services, as they call it, which is very similar in terms of our approach. So it's the beginnings, if you like, and it is new, as I say, of a coalition to promote these ideas and develop them and discuss them, because we haven't got all the answers by any stretch of the imagination right now.
So is your main target audience policymakers, or would you like to do public outreach in the longer term as well?
Well, I mean, in the longer term, the wider public. In the medium term, we're looking to policymakers. In the short and immediate term, we're looking to other policy institutes and NGOs, whoever we can talk to.
It sounds like you're off to a very promising start. What are some of the next steps you think you'd like to take from here?
One is to have a fairly well-organised debate with frontline service workers and their trade unions. And we've got a special project to do that, to find out how they see this issue, how they would envisage universal services, what they think needs to change or what they think is already good and we need more of. So there's that. And also, of course, to get them on board with the idea. And the second thing is to talk in a fairly concerted fashion with people who support the idea of a Green New Deal, because the Green New Deal has been very specifically environmental, although most advocates of Green New Deal and the Green Deal in Europe and various others call various things in different parts of the world, they understand that you need not just to save the planet, but to promote social justice at the same time. But they often lack the policies or the sort of, the approach that you need in order to put these two things together, social justice and sustainability. So that's what we're trying to do, to have a structured conversation with people who are engaged in campaigning for a Green New Deal. So those are two of the things we're doing. And in the UK, we're talking to politicians across different parties to get them to support the idea over the next 12 months or so.
Have you been encouraged by receptivity levels among policymakers to your ideas? And do people seem open to talking about it and getting it more on the mainstream political agenda?
Yes. One of the things I think is that it depends on the party and who the politicians are. But what we probably need is for the politicians who will eventually or do already have the power to make something of this in practice is to find their own way of expressing it. They're not going to take the social guarantee off the shelf and say, this is what we want, because most politicians like to have their own ideas. So we're hoping to persuade as many politicians as we can to come up with their own version of the social guarantee and use our ideas to help populate their vision and to help inform their vision. And that will be how we will get it onto the mainstream policy agenda. There are always politicians who are more open, who are prepared to say, yeah, we like what you're saying, we like the language you're using, but if they want to use their own language, then that's fine with us.
As you were developing the ideas around the social guarantee, you pulled together some really useful examples of how UBS might be able to make a positive difference at the local level if it was implemented. Could you maybe talk us through some of those?
Well, I mean, there are loads of examples. One of the things we've done over the last, working on universal basic services over the last couple of years, is to do a pretty exhaustive amount of research around practical examples, in particularly in European countries, but also elsewhere, of what it might begin to look like in practice. So, for example, you can go to Tallinn, which is the capital of Estonia, and see that they've introduced a free bus service, universal free bus service. You can look at the way that the city of Vienna owns land in order and organizes its housing so that people do have access to much better quality housing, regardless of their income, than they would, say, in the UK. You can look at Norway and their model of childcare, which combines, you know, good standards and decent paying conditions for childcare workers with ways of funding it that mean that it's affordable for everyone. So we've tried to put all these together, and we're also still building up that list of what it might look like in practice, but we couldn't point to any one country and say, oh, well, you know, if only we did what they do there. But there's examples all around the world of good services, universal, of prefigurative universal basic services.
I think there's something really nice in these examples, in that in one sense they're very small, but they're also extremely meaningful. Childcare is huge for people who receive it. Bus travel is huge for people who receive that. So even if it's on a very localized level, the difference it can make to communities can be profound and quite quick. And I think that's something that feels very encouraging as people who want to bring change. You don't always have to do the huge thing. You can do the small thing and still make a very big difference.
There is one London authority, Camden Council, which has started taking up the idea of universal basic services, looking at their population, their own residents, saying, well, what do people need that they're not getting? And they looked at, this is during the COVID lockdowns, and they recognised that low-income families did not have equal access to the internet. And so they went about finding residents who needed it and making sure they had a device, internet access, and the skills they needed to use them. And so that's only starting in a very small, very modest way, but it does show what could be done, and that's what we're interested in.
And policymakers also tend to like what's already been tried and what's already worked. So if one place tries it and it works, it feels like the chance of another place trying it and it working again goes up. And I guess that feels like each little trial we do has the potential to spread things further.
And I mean, you could look at London. I mean, across Greater London, we have the Transport for London, which is the transport authority for the whole of London, which is hugely diverse, with many different boroughs, with different councils, you know, with making different kinds of decisions. But right across London, you've got one transport system that makes sure, as far as it can, that the transport is well connected across the borough, that it's there for everyone. And then, of course, they have free passes for people over at the age of 60. And one of the things that we're suggesting is that that's the model, a free bus pass for everyone. Wouldn't cost a great deal more and could transform the lives of many people, if everybody could have what people over 60 get.
Yeah, particularly in big cities, the options seem almost endless in that sense, because there's so many ways that public transit can bring social and environmental change and benefits.
Transport's quite a good example as well about how you really have to get down into what people need in their own neighbourhoods, because I've described what works, or what could work a lot better even in London, but does work pretty well already. But if you're living out in a rural community, you need a very different kind of transport. You need to make sure that there are bus services, that they are available to you if you're not near a railway station, that they run at the right times, that they connect you with things you need to be connected with. And what the last thing you need for transport is this completely disconnected bundle of private sector organisations who run bus companies under various franchises across the country. None of them connect with each other. They don't have the same ticketing system. It's a complete dog's breakfast. That, again, is another example of how a universal service would look very different, and how you can learn from what's wrong as well as what's gone right in other places.
I suppose, just to quickly build on that example, that when a lot of people think about universal basic services, we kind of automatically assume, based on history, that the state is going to be the provider and it will be a monolithic entity that makes all those decisions for us. Where does your idea for UBS stand on that spectrum?
That's really important because, yes, it is a misunderstanding that if you talk about universal services, people think it's all about top-down provision by a monolithic state telling people what's good for them and giving them things that they think they need rather than what people themselves need. And so we make a great deal of the fact that we think there should be a great many different models of ownership and control of, for service provision. So the service providers don't all have to be state-run institutions. They could be local community groups, they could be social enterprises, they could be cooperatives. And the critical thing is that they could be private sector organizations too. They all need to follow and be bound by the same set of public interest obligations. And this is what we might call a system of social licensing that would be administered by government for the public. Say that whoever you are, wherever you are, if you're providing a universal service or a public service in your area, you do need to meet these criteria to behave in this way. And that would include running the outfit in a sustainable way as possible. So following certain ground rules about emissions and the use of natural resources and so on. So it's about quality, it's about sustainability, it's about affordability too. So it's about collective responsibility infusing a variety of different providers. They won't all be operating in the same way, but they will all have the same set of obligations.
I think there's a related theme that's come across in various questions we've talked about, and that's the idea of UBS being a bottom-up idea in many ways. You mentioned corporate cooperatives there and social enterprises and research among service workers too. So it feels like there's a universality of different ways of doing it, even if we agree that the needs themselves are common among all people.
And that is kind of beyond dispute in a way. It reflects what's in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So that's universal, and the how needs are met, the social guarantee and the idea of universal basic services says that they need to be an entitlement, they need to be sufficient, they need to be of decent quality, and so on. So there are a range of kind of principles that you would apply in every case. But beyond that, there's any amount of variety in what kind of organization would provide services, where power and control would lie. And we, as far as possible, we want power to be devolved, and we want service users to be involved in designing, in identifying how their needs should be met and designing the services. Part of the picture is to encourage co-production where possible between service users and service workers, if you like, working together to construct ways in which needs can be met. So you've got that kind of bottom-upness, and then you've got the variety of different models of ownership, and you've got subsidiarity in control resting at the lowest appropriate level, not just top-down state provision. Although in some services, I mean, certainly in the UK, anyone who suggested that, indeed, it does happen, but the idea that the health service should be broken up so that, you know, every locality has their own individual health service, and there's nothing, you know, holding it all together at a national level would be anathema because you would get huge inequalities. The role of the state within this diverse and locally devolved system is to ensure equality of access, to collect and distribute funds in order to maximize equality of access, and then to set standards and enforce standards, and then to coordinate across the sectors and across the areas of need in order to get the best results all round. Because if you're designing a housing service, for example, you want it to be compatible with the local education service. There are many ways in which it's important to coordinate services. So the state has a very important role, but it's much more about coordination, about regulation and investment, setting standards and so on, and making sure that power is devolved rather than being the default provider, although it will in many circumstances be a provider, but not automatically.
It seems like almost a pre-Ronald Reagan and pre-Margaret Thatcher view of the state as they tried to strip the state back to its bare minimum based on a fundamental mistrust of government. but in a way that's really hollowed out so much social provision and meeting people's needs?
Yes, I mean, there's a history of that, trying to develop what we would call an enabling state, which is sort of, I suppose, it's post-Thatcherite. I mean, we're now living with the consequences of rolling back the state, and they're very dire, especially for people on low incomes, but for all of us, because we all suffer if those who are most vulnerable in society are doing worse than anyone else. It will always come back on everyone. So we're, you know, that phrase, we're all in it together. We are. We have learned that you need the state, that the state or government, let's say government institutions, public institutions, are a really important way in which we can promote and ensure that we promote the means to greater inequality between localities as well as between individuals and groups.
I liked what you were saying earlier as well about more community involvement from the bottom up, in the sense that it goes back to what you said about Martha Nussbaum and our critical capabilities. It almost feels like we're becoming better citizens through the provision of universal basic services because we're more politically engaged, politically involved, and we feel more empowered, and that our voice can make a difference, starting at the community level.
It's about giving people more control over their own lives, which is really important, because if people have no control, they don't see any point of getting involved in politics until it gets to a point where, you know, there's conflict, and then, you know, it's usually the weak who lose out first and most. So if you can put people, more people in more control of their immediate daily lives and circumstances through universal basic services and the other elements of the social guarantee, that will help to build a sense of solidarity, and it will help to build the capacity and the trust that you need for democratic engagement.
Having launched the social guarantee in the middle of a pandemic, do you think that COVID and the response to it, both from government and through a lot of the communal structures that people have arranged themselves, have maybe opened the door to new thinking on UBS and similar subjects, maybe thinking that we might not have had without a health crisis of the scale that we've been suffering through? Because it's definitely exposed some big problems, but maybe also exposed some good solutions as a kind of silver lining to a very big cloud.
Yes, I think we've learned that certain services are really important to us. We've learned the importance of care services, particularly. We've learned what it means not to have schools open. We've learned how much we depend on the National Health Service. I'm talking about the UK context here, how much we need health services. So we've learned those things. I mean, my worry is that, you know, governments have thrown everything they can at the problem, and that they will now row back and introduce a new era of austerity, and then people will be even worse off. Certainly the critical thing is put the money down locally where people need it. So local authorities across the UK need that money to be able to run and to help or to enable the services that can happen locally. So if you're starving your local state institutions of funds, then you've got no possibility of being able to grow this kind of sector. Because we've also learned, I think another important lesson we learned was from David Cameron's experiment with what he called the big society. And it quickly became clear that all he was doing was trying to dump responsibility on people outside, you know, in their local communities. And of course, what you immediately found was that the poorest communities had the least resources already and were the most least likely to benefit. So you simply had widening inequalities. So you don't want to dump responsibility on local authorities, but you do want to devolve power and resources to localities so that people can have more control, more power, and feel that they've got more power over their immediate circumstances.
Saying the name David Cameron should really come with a trigger warning, but I'm going to soldier on through it, probably against the advice of my therapist. But I think you're right about austerity, because it was the same kind of thing with the 2008 financial crisis. It felt like there was a golden window of a few months where big change could have happened, but it didn't. And then suddenly we were plunged into, in the UK at least, closing libraries and closing post offices as somehow being the solution to this huge problem. And I could definitely see how that could happen again.
And all those things like libraries and community centres are a really important part of enabling people to get their what they need in life, to have their have access to life's essentials. So you do need those things. It's not they're not just nice to haves. They're kind of absolutely necessary in every community. And I mean, one of the things we did learn from the COVID experiment was if the government wants to spend money, wants to invest public funds on something, it can, it will. And that happened before as well, after the 2008 crash, that money was always there if the government wants to spend it. People say, well, it'll cost a lot to have universal basic services. Yes, it will. Not a huge amount, but much, much more better value for money and much less expensive than introducing a sufficient universal basic income, I can tell you. But nevertheless, if the government decides it wants to spend the money, it's there. They can usually find it. They can find it.
Yeah, I think the 2008 crisis was basically a socialism for the rich experiment, wasn't it? I guess at least with COVID, we've seen governments in some countries try and spread their financial support a little bit more broadly. In the US, for example, was sending out checks to pretty much the entire population, I think, on a fairly regular basis throughout the pandemic as a way to help people who've lost their jobs who are struggling financially. And I guess in one sense, that could be considered a prototype for universal basic income. And we've teased that subject a lot through various questions and answers so far. So I'm wondering if you could tell me why you think we should maybe be skeptical about universal basic income, or why we should make universal basic services the priority instead.
Well, I think there's a lot of kind of lazy terminology used by some advocates of universal basic income, because it's never clear what you actually mean by income, universal or basic. And they're always saying how there've been all these wonderful field experiments with UBI, and yet none of them has ever translated into a system that is established for a whole population, a universal income for a whole population over any sustained period of time. So the trouble with universal basic income is that it's a kind of a silver bullet, which I thoroughly disapprove of. The idea that we have a problem. Well, here's the answer. The answer is universal basic income. And usually when people talk about UBI schemes that are affordable, they mean they're paying a very small amount to a selected portion of the population, not to everyone, or an even tinier amount to everyone if they're going to make it genuinely universal. And so it's never enough to live on. If you're going to make it enough to live on, you're going to have to strip money away from a whole lot of other things. And even where there is, there is a lot of money that can be found to spend on things like this, it's much more urgently needed for the green transition, green infrastructure, the Green New Deal, and for more and better public services, and just throw it all away to giving people money who don't need money is absolutely irresponsible, in my view. However, having said all that, and I've had lots of arguments with people in the UBI camp over quite a number of years, because it does have a kind of a cultish feel to it. People talk about believing in UBI. But the principle that everyone should have access to a sufficient income is absolutely right. And we can call it UBI if it'll help them. It won't be UBI, but you can call it a universal basic income guarantee, if you like, so that it's paid to people who need it. And you can do a great deal to make the system for claiming cash benefits more benign, less stigmatizing. You can make it automatic if you like, and then claim it back if it's you've paid people too much money. There are all sorts of schemes that have been developed for a guaranteed income floor, as some people call it, or a guaranteed minimum income. And those work. They're more affordable. They're more rational. They are very close to some of the most important principles of the UBI, some of the UBI campaigns. So it's a kind of, what I like to see cash benefits and income benefits as two sides of the same coin. And we need them both. But what you don't want is one side to obliterate the other side. And we're not suggesting for a minute that services should obliterate cash payments. All you need is services. Nobody needs income support. But we are saying that if you have decent services, you'll need much less in the way of income support. If you're not paying for things like childcare, if your rent is affordable, if you don't have to pay for care when you're elderly or disabled, if you're not paying for healthcare or education, then these things represent part of that income that everybody needs. But it's in kind, not cash.
It feels like there's several flaws in the test of UBI. If 500 people in a small group are getting an extra $500 a month that nobody else gets, I'd feel better about that too, because it doesn't connect to the wider economy. But if you suddenly start providing everybody with $500 a month, wouldn't the market just adjust to that and suddenly the impact of it would be completely diluted? And then you're kind of back to where you started.
And also there are two critiques of UBI. One is that it's a hugely powerful single lever in the hands of the state. So another government could come in and just turn it off and nobody gets the income anymore. And the other is that even if it is being paid out, it does nothing to disrupt anything about the capitalist economy. It just puts money into the system for people to go on shopping, which is why all those tycoons in Silicon Valley like the idea, because they know that the way they're going, and if they can keep on going the way they're going, there will be fewer jobs for people. They just want a population that's got just enough money to keep on shopping while they can keep on making their profits. But we're saying something different here. We're saying what we need is a system that makes sure everybody gets what they need. And that is going to have to mean a different kind of a system from one suggested by the advocates of UBI, most of the advocates of UBI.
Seeing as we've just taken a trip to Silicon Valley, I'm going to flip the conversation here a little bit. And I'm wondering whether we could categorize Facebook as a universal basic service. It's used by over 2 billion people. It's entrenched in so many areas of everyday life. And in some countries, it's basically synonymous with internet access. What do you think about that idea?
What I would say to that is that access to the internet, to digital information and communications, ought to be a universal entitlement. And then what that consists of should be a matter for, up to a certain extent, to individual choice. But it's also, and this would apply across the board for universal services, some of these decisions are best put to the people to decide. So we want to have citizens' juries and citizens' assemblies that will help to identify and to define what universal services are. So what would digital access look like? Ideally, what should people have? I don't think that I would say that everyone should have Facebook. These are things that you can, just as in certainly in the UK, there's been focus group based research that has identified what people think is a minimum income standard. So you can use a similar approach, although I'd have more deliberative dialogue and less focus groups. That's another discussion. To try to decide as a population in localities what services are needed, what we should give priority to, who should be, you know, are there limits to eligibility? These are all questions that we can't answer, but we think should be a matter for genuine democratic dialogue and democratic decision making.
I think that leads quite nicely into the area I'd like to talk about next, which is describing some of the more concrete benefits of UBS. I think we've touched on a lot of them already, but maybe you could break down some of the benefits you see from your work with the social guarantee and your wider research.
Yes, well, we've identified four main areas where we think there are benefits. I think there are others as well, actually. Let's talk about five. The first is greater equality. And that's because these in-kind benefits have a strongly redistributive. So they are worth much more to low-income families, but everybody gets them so when they need them. So they're not selective in that they only go to the poor. They're not about just keeping the poor, so they're just okay. They're for everyone. So that's the first thing. The second thing is they offer greater efficiency than just a whole lot of individual market transactions. You lose some of the transaction costs. You've got economies of scale. You've got a much wiser use of public resources than you would if you were just giving money to people to spend in the marketplace. And one example of that is if you look at the costs of the US healthcare system, which is largely market-based, not entirely market-based, but largely market-based, and you compare the cost of that system to the cost of the UK system, that is largely a collective system, then it's much more expensive. The US healthcare is much more expensive, and you get a far lower average life expectancy in the US than you do in the UK. So worse healthcare, more money, and it's also less sustainable. So that's one way of looking at it. The next one is solidarity, that we think it, we've talked about this a bit already, that we think it's a good way of getting people together, of helping people to see how they share the same interests and how they, it's why it's important to share risks and pool resources and work together. And then last but not least, or at least penultimate but not least, it's more sustainable, because you can, through these public interest obligations or the social licensing system that we've talked about, you can get providers to run their outfits in ways that are more sustainable. And also a collective system is inherently more sustainable than a collection of individual transactions for a number of reasons I haven't got time to go into now. And then the other one, the fifth benefit is the way that it generates jobs. So universal basic services can generate employment at all skill levels in all parts of the country. Because unlike other things where you tend to get, you know, centres of excellence, or cities suck jobs into them, don't they? But you, wherever you are, you always need services. You need education and transport and childcare. And these generate jobs, and they generate, on the whole, jobs that are not as vulnerable as others, to automation. So they're jobs that are about relationships and about people rather than just doing things. They are sustainable jobs. They are at all skill levels, as I say, and right across the country. And that's really important for the economy too, and for the post-capitalist economy too.
It really seems to fit into thinking about the care economy too, and all those intangible things that people do that are thoroughly neglected by any kind of classical economics, but absolutely essential to the functioning of society.
Yes, because, I mean, if you take adult social care, for example, where you know, care that you might need when you're older, it's not just about providing the care directly. It's also about supporting informal carers. So you need to see it in the round, that service. So a universal care service would include support for people who are caring at home for their relatives. It is a rounded view of bringing together unpaid and paid labour and valuing both.
Speaking of a more rounded view, it also feels like we're potentially introducing a whole new way to think about and to measure progress. At the moment, so much of what we think of as progress is framed in terms of growth and things getting bigger. And I think this idea that there's a whole other slate of ways that we can think about what progress looks like, from the Global Happiness Index or providing access to basic services, it seems to open up a whole range of possibilities that have been neglected by very sophisticated but not very realistic economic models.
Well, that was the really worth pointing out, that universal basic services grew out of the New Economics Foundation, which also initiated a lot of thinking about well-being and the idea of a Happy Planet Index and having different ways of measuring economic success that wasn't all about economic growth. So it's come out of that stable of people who've been working in this field for a long time, trying to say we need an economy that has different objectives from what we have now. It's not just growing and at the expense of all other things. It is about increasing human well-being. In order to increase human well-being and planetary well-being, you need to have ways in which everyone has access to life's essentials. And that's where the social guarantee and universal basic services come in.
Another question I have is that a lot of the examples we've talked about come from affluent Western nations. If we think about how UBS might be applied in developing countries, though, are we thinking about the same way of approaching the model with a bottom-up structure to idea and solution generation, or is there something different we should be considering here?
If you, given that it's based in need theory, and need theory recognises that while needs are universal, needs are met in huge variety of different ways, depending on the local circumstances, on history, on cultural expectations, on resources that are available, and so on. You can apply the same approach in countries of different income levels. And you just have to work with people to say, well, what do you need? What do you need most? How can we get it? How can we make sure that happens? And that's, you know, so you might start with education. If you've got education, you might go on to healthcare. If you've got healthcare, you might go on to childcare and transport. You might still be at a point where you're still trying to get clean water to people. And you know that that's the case in many poor countries, that what they need first and foremost is food and water. And then they need housing and so on. So it's a matter of setting priorities according to the circumstances in which people live and according to what they, how they identify what they need.
There's something quite intriguing about UBS as well, in that there's a chance to step outside the usual world of intellectual property and trademarks that define capitalism and think about a post-capitalist principle where there's the possibility of much greater sharing and knowledge transfer. So it's not just a zero-sum game at that point. And that's quite an appealing cosmopolitan element to the idea as well.
So actually, I hadn't really thought about that, but you're quite right. I mean, you can have decent universal services in every country without them there being any need for them to be in competition with one another. And that is really important when you think about it, yes. So that's your point, but I agree with you.
I'll let you have that for free, which is kind of the spirit of our conversation, so I'm glad we're putting it into practice already. I know we're running out of time too, so I wanted to ask a really quick last question. As individuals, as we're thinking about how we try and advance the case for universal basic services, what are some of the things that we could do, do you think?
Go to the website, start talking about it, chat to other people, think about how it applies to their own situation, talk to their members of parliament or their local council. There's any number of things that people can do. And I hope that, you know, in a year's time, we'll have a lot more to offer in terms of the information that we've got, the tools that we've got, and so on. But, you know, because we are still in an early stage, there's an opportunity for people to come in and help shape it. Ask us difficult questions, you know, with debating it with people that you know. Think about how it applies to the circumstances you find in whatever country you happen to be, and in your locality, in your neighbourhood, in your region, in national state level, and so on. If the social guarantee is something you can organise a policy campaign around, universal basic services, because of difficulty of the language, is there in the social guarantee anyway. So yeah, let's have a global campaign for a social guarantee.
Anna, thanks so much for joining me today. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Pleasure, my pleasure.
That's it for this episode. More information about Anna Coote and the subjects we discussed are available on her episode page at postcapitalismpodcast.com. Our music is by Chocolat Billy. More information about them is available on our website. And if you'd like to get in touch, please do email us at info@postcapitalismpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.